This archived broadcast of Janet Meffer Today is brought to you by Preborn. We're wanting to save 250 preborn babies this January by offering free ultrasounds to women in crisis pregnancies. You can help by calling 855-402-BABY. That's 855-402-2229 or janetmefford.com.
This is Janet Meffer Today.
Our confidence is in Christ alone.
Are we going to stand with God, come what may?
If the Word of God says it, I believe it.
And that's the way it is.
And now, here is Janet Meffer.
Welcome, everybody. I saw something incredible today on the internet. Apparently, there's a new film coming out which interviews people like former President Bill Clinton, focusing on the rise of anti-Semitic attacks in the U.S. and Europe. But there was also this interesting quote from another person who apparently is involved in the film, moderate Muslim activist Majid Nawaz. And this is what he said. If we don't draw a red line in the sand when it comes to anti-Semitism, Muslims will be next. Well, wait a minute. While it is true that there have been some terrible anti-Semitic attacks on Jews by non-Muslims, one study conducted among Western European Jews actually showed that those who experienced violence or threats largely experienced them at the hands of Muslims. And this is interesting as well. Just recently, the German weekly news magazine Der Spiegel interviewed a French philosopher who observed that Germany is encountering a different new anti-Semitism. And who is spreading it? Well, Muslim immigrants. But the anti-Semitism is anything but new. So how do we deal effectively with anti-Semitism when it is baked into Islamic theology? That's a challenge. And we're going to talk about it today with Dr. Andrew Bostom. He is an Islamic scholar and author, and he is just out with an updated version of his great book called The Legacy of Islamic Anti-Semitism. Dr. Bostom, wonderful to welcome you back to the show. How are you?
Thank you for having me on, Janet. I'm also a particular thanks about citing that quote by Majid Nawaz. I'm just floored by that.
Yeah. I mean,
he's supposed to be one of the good guys.
That's right. What, isn't he opposed to Islamic extremism, and yet he's trying to imply that anti-Semitic attacks are, I guess, never committed by Muslims? That's insane.
It's really mind-boggling. I mean, we've spoken in the past, for example, about Kanta Ahmed here in the United States, who's also touted as a reformer, and her apologetics about what Islamic doctrine actually teaches about the Jews. And it's really why, Janet, to jump right into it, it's really why I made an emphasis when I was talking about what real reform would look like, and the reforms would have to be quite wrenching. I cited those I've come to call conscientious objectors to Islam, born and raised within Muslim culture, but public intellectuals like Ayan Hirsi Ali, like the Syrian psychiatrist Wafa Sultan, who have their own way of defining who they are. Wafa actually considers herself still part of the Islamic world. Ayan really doesn't. But regardless, they're brutally honest about how hardwired anti-Semitism is into not just Islamic texts, the fundamental texts of Islam, the Quran, the traditions of Muhammad, etc., but also into the upbringing of Muslim children, sadly, in the Muslim world. And so for a Majid Nawaz or a Kanta Ahmed to not even be willing to grapple with that, both its theological roots and its cultural roots, is just mind-boggling. But it's just very consistent with the entire denial coming from the non-Muslim world about this problem.
Wow. It's crazy. And like I said before, obviously there have been some horrible anti-Semitic attacks by people who were not Muslims. But it
right.
seems like the left in particular is trying to advance this narrative that the people who commit anti-Semitic attacks are neo-Nazis, they're far-right nationalists, maybe they're just Trump supporters. They seem to leave the category of Islam out of it almost entirely when you look at the propaganda.
Yes, and when we look at actual data, and remember, you introduced Majid Nawaz, so let's speak about Europe. When you talk about Europe, where the academy is quite a bit skewed to the left, even when you look at data coming from the EU or studies of Muslim youth, because that's the next generation, and that's what we have to remain concerned about. I mean, the rates of anti-Semitism and the rates of violence, even worse, are orders of
multiples. You know, right. As an epidemiologist, when you see a risk that's, I don't know, 25% greater than average, you get all excited. We're talking about 2 to 3-fold rates of extreme anti-Semitism amongst the Muslims of Europe compared to whatever comparator you want to make, the general population, Christians, et cetera. ADL just released another depressing set of data back on November 21st for Europe. And then when you start looking at acts of violence, I mean, in the only reliable studies there are where they actually query the Jewish victims, and we're talking obviously about non-lethal violence, it's anywhere from 3 to 13-fold. I mean, the numbers just jump out at you. And some really depressing studies that were done by sociology professors in large samples in Belgium, for example, by Mark Delcardis, and he got pilloried just for doing the studies. He was showing the same sorts of things that if you look at anti-Semitic tropes, Jews want to dominate everything. Jews think they're better than others. The rates amongst Muslims that are young, 12 to 18 years old, are 4 to 7-fold the rates amongst non-Muslims in believing these anti-Semitic tropes.
That's incredible.
So it's continuing. Another sociologist who actually is a Muslim convert, and he sort of bends himself into a pretzel to try and explain away his observations, but at least he reports the results. And he says that in trying to delve into why these Muslim youth have these attitudes, he grudgingly concedes that the majority do not distance themselves from a literal interpretation of the Quran. It's coming from the teachings themselves, and I did try and provide some case studies because I do find they're useful sometimes about the jihadist attackers specifically, Mehdi Nemush, who was a violent jihadist, and Hamida Hossein, who attacked the Great Synagogue in Copenhagen. And you can see that as they become pious, that's when they engage in these acts. Yeah. And in the case of Hamid al-Hussein, you could see all the sermons leading up to his attack that were full of these anti-Semitic motifs from the Quran and the Hadith, including one sermon that he went to allegedly the night before he made his attack. So it's just really disturbing to see some Muslims who, in many respects, I appreciate some of the things they say, but they just like Majid Nawaz, like Kanta Ahmed. I do respect some of the things they say, but when they can't come to terms with these data or the doctrine that drive them, it's not helpful. It's just not helpful.
No, and not honest either. I mean, you and I have talked about this issue, I know, in the past, and we've talked about some of the references in the Quran and the Hadith that fuels this ideology. But what would you point to as the main sections of Islamic theology that are driving this anti-Semitism?
Well, I think it starts with, again, this is particularly observant Muslims. There's a very short chapter, surah, put onto the Quran, obviously after the fact, but we don't have to get into the history of that. But basically, it's called the opening or the Fatiha. It's a very short surah of 7 verses, and the 7th verse says that Muslims should not follow the path of those who've incurred Allah's anger. And those are the Jews. And it's been linked in 1,300 years worth of Quranic commentaries and explanations to other Quranic verses, one infamous one which calls the Jews apes and pigs as part of their curse. And it's basically something that gets repeated by a pious Muslim. If they're going to go through all 5 prayer sessions a day, there are subunits of these prayer sessions. They would repeat that specific verse 17 times a day. To me, it's a form of brainwashing. And now, while some of the interpretations of that verse aren't specific to that reference of incurring anger to the Jews,
I've studied this. Over 90% of the great commentaries across the span of 13 centuries make a specific reference to the Jews. So that's the predominant teaching. That's not the radical teaching. That's not the outlier teaching.
Well, this is important. We have to pause for a very quick break, but I want to come back and get into more about this. The Legacy of Islamic Antisemitism, new updated version of it out now from Dr. Andrew Bostom, who is joining us. We'll come right back to the discussion here on Janet Mefford Today. It's Sanctity of Human Life Month, the month we set aside each year to remember the millions of lives lost through the scourge of abortion. But even while we mourn the loss of so many babies, pro-abortion politicians in the House of Representatives are looking to push legislation that would expand access to abortion. It's more important than ever before to fight for human life. That's why we're partnering with the Ministry of Preborn. Preborn funds pregnancy centers across the nation so they can offer free ultrasounds to women in crisis pregnancy. Ultrasound is a game changer because when abortion-minded women actually see their babies in their wombs for themselves, 80% of the time, they choose life. We want to save the lives of 250 preborn children this January, and we know it can be done, but we do need your help. Would you please join us at Janet Mefford today to support the Ministry of Preborn and give life to 250 babies this January? For $140, you can provide five free ultrasounds to women in crisis pregnancies. A gift of $22 will provide one ultrasound, and every gift helps. To donate, please call now, 855-402-BABY. That's 855-402-2229, or there's a banner to click at janetmefford.com. All gifts are tax deductible, and 100% of your gift goes directly towards saving babies. Think of the children in the womb this January. You can get involved, and you can help save a life for a gift of $140. Five free ultrasounds will be offered to women in crisis pregnancies. During the Sanctity of Human Life Month, let's do more than talk about abortion. Let's save some lives. Please call now with your gift, 855-402-BABY. That's 855-402-BABY. 855-402-2229. Or there's a banner to click at janetmefford.com.
You're listening to Janet Mefford Today. And now, here's Janet.
Welcome back. Glad to have you with us today and glad to have with us Islamic scholar Dr. Andrew Bostom. He is out with an updated version of his great book called The Legacy of Islamic Antisemitism, From Sacred Texts to Solemn History. And we see more and more of this push, especially on the left, from people who really want to dodge the issue of Muslim antisemitism, especially as it's coming out in the European continent, where you see these attacks and the rise of antisemitism having really scary effects on the Jews who live there. And you know, some of these statistics, Dr. Bostom, are really, really disturbing. And you can't blame Jews who live in Western Europe for being more and more scared and more alarmed by what's going on. And yet, you had mentioned this Der Spiegel interview. This philosopher, French philosopher, was interviewed. And I want to read a part of what he said in this interview. He said, "Will Germany react to the new anti-Semitism with exactly the same harshness and relentlessness as against the emergence or reappearance of neo-Nazism? We'll see about that. Germany may find this just as difficult as France." Well, how in the world are they going to stand up to this when it's not politically correct to stand up to this?
Well, and also, with all due respect to Elaine Finkielkraut, I mean, the idea of conceptualizing this as new is absurd.
Yes.
The largest pogrom in Western European history to that date was the same year as the Battle of Hastings, 1066. It took place in Grenada, Spain. It literally wiped out the entire community. And this is supposed to be in an area that, you know, we're taught as children, perhaps, you know, the Andalusian paradise. This was a model for interfaith relations. I mean, it's all mythology. But the point is that with this ridiculous term, new anti-Semitism, and specifically referring to the influx of Muslims in the modern era into Europe, bringing anti-Semitic baggage with them. I get all that. I mean, and that's true. But the idea is that it's still a negation of the doctrine in history to refer to it as new when you have this horrific example in Muslim Spain, literally incited by this Quranic verse epithet of the Jews as apes. And so I appreciate what Alain Finkielkraut was trying to say, and I absolutely agree with him. And I don't want to lose, you know, the point that he was trying to make. And in fact, he's right. I mean, you know, they should be dealing in Germany and France, et cetera, with these anti-Semitic attacks coming from the Muslim community and Muslims with the same harshness they deal with the anti-Semitic attacks that are much rarer of the neo-Nazis. And they're obviously not willing to do that. I mean, there have been horrific examples of Muslims getting off literally killing Jews in France with defenses of mental health. Even more recently, this brutal torture murder of Sarah Halimi, the perpetrator thus far has gotten off because he smoked a joint before this attack.
Oh, good grief. That's so insane.
I mean, so I understand the point that he's making, but again, it does reinforce from my perspective the historical and doctrinal illness, and it's the third rail. They don't want to go back to what this very unpleasant legacy is, which is what I recorded in this depressing massive tome I've reproduced.
Yes.
And the tremendous consistency of it across 13 centuries. It's got to be addressed because it never went away. And now that there's this mixing of cultures, it's coming back.
It is. I saw just a couple of days ago, within this past week, a story where the Pope was decrying anti-Semitism and talking about Auschwitz and the terrors and all the rest. But I thought, well, this is the same Pope that does outreach to the Muslim community and has done all kinds of interfaith ecumenical sort of reactions to the Islamic community. And this seems to be something that, to some extent, the politicians do as well, which is we're scared of you, so we don't want to offend you, and we're hoping at some point your goodwill will kick in. But is it just fear? Do you think that's really what's driving the political response?
I've begun to appreciate that it's fear. And in the Pope's case, I think he's fearful, or at least initially he was fearful of the vulnerable, you know, Catholic communities within the Muslim world. I think he's now becoming fearful of the of Catholics in their native countries, and he's fearing for them in Europe. I mean, it's an absurd way to deal with the problem. And you know, there are these tendencies that basically want to merge Christianity and Islam.
Oh yeah,
there's a movement to do this. Even one, believe it or not, within the Catholic Church, it's not like a fringe movement. And so I don't know how much of that plays a role. But one of the persons he's been dialoguing with consistently is the current Grand Imam of Al Azhar University, Ahmed Al Tayeb, and Al Tayeb is very much a traditionalist in the bigoted sense. Muslim, and certainly what he said in particular about Jews, he's a little milder when it comes to Christians, but in particular what he said about Jews is to restate for eternity this another central Quranic verse that's very anti-Semitic, which is in the fifth surah, the fifth chapter, the 82nd verse, which talks about how the Jews, it's sort of a transference verse, how the Jews harbor this great hostility towards the Muslims. And Tab gave an interview, a full interview, where he just said that's what's defined the relationship, and he conflates deliberately. He puts together deliberately. He doesn't conflate. He actually equates Jews and Zionists, Judaism and Zionists. He says for 1,400 years, this verse has defined our relationship, and that's what's caused so much pain for the Muslims.
Wow.
So this is someone that the Pope is reaching out to. And it's very interesting. When Tayeb gave this interview, no one was saying anything about it. So I'm actually friendly with the much demonized Dutch politician Geert Wilders.
Yes.
And Geert is very knowledgeable about Islam. And I wrote to him and I said, please, you know, no one is saying anything. Could you say something about this, what Tayeb said in this interview? And Geert wrote something very, very informed and elegant and criticized him and urged Pope Francis to criticize Tayeb. And, of course, you know, it fell upon deaf ears.
Right, right. Wow. Well, yeah, he's awesome. He's taken so much just for standing up in his own country. But, yeah, this is the problem, and it gets very confused. But when we're looking at Islamic anti-Semitism in tandem with the massive movement of Muslim immigrants into Western Europe— Is the result inevitable, do you feel? Obviously, not every Muslim who comes into Western Europe is going to commit violent jihad, but how do you see this cauldron erupting at some point?
Well, I think we've already seen it. I mean, I think that's what's driving these data. I think that's why both the anti-Semitic attitudes and the anti-Semitic violence are so disproportionately already Muslim in Europe.
Right.
That's clearly what's happening. More conservative politician that the European left loves to hate, Salvini, basically just said that. He said that the reason that we're having, he did this in the past week, the reason that we're having this explosion of anti-Semitism in Europe is because of the Muslim immigrant population.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. They don't want to hear that.
He admitted there are other forms, but that's what's driving the most prevalent and most aggressive form.
Right. Now, what about in the United States? Because there continue to be battles over refugee resettlement, and you've got all kinds of political factions talking about that, and President Trump getting handed down a decision recently saying that you can't allow the governors to decide how many refugees they want to resettle. And I've talked about this quite a lot on my show. It's somewhat of a huge racket in some respects because you have these VOLAGs that have a financial interest in resettling as many people as possible, but no accountability. These people are coming from places in large measure that they can't be vetted. They're fully vetted. And then they come over here and then we've seen what goes on. But you look, for example, at Ilhan Omar's district. This is a perfect example of what's going on. The squad that we deride for their leftist progressivism and Ilhan Omar saying some people did something on 9/11.
Right.
This is also the legacy, isn't it, of Islamic theology?
Absolutely. But we have hard metrics. So in other words, the ADL data, which are the best data really on global anti-Semitism, and we've talked brief about them, but just really to recap briefly, they basically have a scale that they developed out of responses to 11 anti-Semitic stereotypes. And if you agree with six out of those, you shouldn't agree with any of them, frankly, but if you agree with six, at least six of them, then you're defined as an extreme anti-Semite. And then they go and they look at how common that degree of anti-Semitism is in all the populations they survey. Well, they finally did studies in the United States, 2016 through early 2017, and what they found is that it's the same thing as the rest of the world. The background rates in non-Muslims are lower in this country. It's a more philo-Semitic country, largely, I think, you know, frankly, because of the evangelical population in this country.
Yep.
But at any rate, it's a lower background rate. So it's 14%, which is higher than you might think, but it's not bad for the rest of the world. And amongst the Muslims in this country already, it was 34%. So the absolute rate was lower in this country, which is good, but it was still 2.4 full times the general population. I also, for the book, reviewed that since 9/11, there have been 23 Muslim jihadist type attacks specifically targeting Jews.
Wow.
There were, if you throw in now, and by the way, this is not getting nearly enough attention, the Monsey Synagogue machete slasher, Grafton Thomas, is a Muslim convert. We have two sources to validate that, a police source, and more importantly, his stepfather of 10 years.
I had seen that, and that wasn't widely reported. Yep.
No, and he clearly has mental health problems. But he, if you read the criminal complaint against Grafton Thomas, he knew exactly what he was doing. He plotted it out. He had all kinds of hateful attitudes towards Jews, and he wound up attacking a synagogue, you know, not a Buddhist temple. So it's very clear, whatever his mental illness is, that he was specific, and he in fact has been charged with a hate crime, whatever people think of hate crimes. So in other words, there's enough cognitive awareness that he knew what he was doing, and he was targeting Jews.
Yep.
And so he made the 23rd either planned or thwarted attack. So there have been 16 thwarted attacks, which could have been very big in size.
Yes.
And there have been 7 completed attacks. And if there's a man in a coma from Grafton Thomas's attack, so that he would be the ninth.
I'll tell you what, it's a great chart to look through, a great book to look through, The Legacy of Islamic Antisemitism, Dr. Andrew Bostom. Thank you so much, Dr. Bostom, for being with us, and we'll be right back. This archived broadcast of Janet Mefford Today is brought to you by Preborn. We're wanting to save 250 preborn babies this January by offering free ultrasounds to women in crisis pregnancies. You can help by calling 855-402-BABY. That's 855-402-2229 or janetmefford.com.
This is Janet Mefford Today. And now, here's your host, Janet Mefford.
Well, I have to get to this story because it just goes to show you that everything we've been saying all along about Big Gay is absolutely on the money. Did you hear about this Denver Post columnist who says he was fired for saying that there are two sexes? Now, this didn't surprise me at all. It didn't surprise me at all. I'm going to get into that. I'm going to hold off on telling you why that is. But yes, his name is John Caldara. He's the president of the Libertarian Independence Institute. This is via the Washington Free Beacon. He announced that he's been fired from the Denver Post, chalking it up to a difference in style that his editors found too insensitive. He put out a whole post on Facebook. It's long, so I can't really read it to you. But it basically, he says, my column is not a soft-voiced, sticky, sweet, NPR-styled piece, which employs the language now mandated by the victim-centric, identity politics-driven media. What seemed to be the last straw for my column was my insistence that there are only two sexes, and my frustration that to be inclusive of the transgendered, even that word isn't allowed, we must lose our right to free speech. Caldera criticized an Associated Press directive saying that sex and gender are not binary. Now, I want to pause for a moment and tell you about this, because since I was a journalist for years. We have a Bible, small b, in journalism, which is known as the AP style book. And that is the reference book of choice for all journalists. If you are writing for a newspaper like I did for a long time and you want to write about something and you're not sure how the style is supposed to be, you go to your AP style book and you look it up, and it's all alphabetical like a dictionary, and you find that particular entry and then you see how you're supposed to write it in order to be consistent with all the other pieces in the newspaper on the next day or any day that you write. So what happened was, I go back to this story from a couple of years back. This was the Washington Times in March of 2017. And the headline was, Associated Press issues new guidance on sex and gender. Avoid referring to both or either sexes. So the entry that was put into the AP style book that all journalists use under the category of gender, they put not synonymous with sex. Gender refers to a person's social identity, while sex refers to biological characteristics. Not all people fall under one or two categories for sex or gender, according to leading medical organizations. So avoid references to both, either, or opposite sexes or genders as a way to encompass all people. When needed for clarity or in certain stories about scientific studies, alternatives include men and women, boys and girls, males and females. Now, I don't know what they've done since then. That was 3 years ago, which in big gay activism is, you know, it's basically a millennium. So I don't know if they've updated it to make it even more insane. What I imagine they probably have. But I know exactly what happened here. What happened here was back in the 90s, and I did an entire breakout session at the Restored Hope Network conference in San Diego several years ago on this particular subject, how the media was taken over by Big Gay. What happened was back in the 1990s, you had a number of big media organizations like the Washington Post, the New York Times, and others who courted gay activists to come into the newsroom. Groups like GLAAD, for example, they would come into the newsroom and they would get advice from these activists on how they should talk about homosexuality. Sexual issues. Now, what do you think is going to happen when you let the sexual radicals in to tell you how you are to write about them? Well, one of the casualties early on was the A and B version of any story pertaining to homosexuality was eradicated over the next couple of years. And I showed all these stories from the early 90s going on into the late 90s. And I showed how organizations, media outlets like the New York Times and the Washington Post, they just stop. You know, they stopped telling the truth. They stopped telling the other side of the story. So, for example, in 1992, there might be a discussion about gays in the military. And you would have a story in one of these major newspapers where they would quote some gay activist and they would talk about the gays in the military. It's a big controversy. And then they would interview Penny Nance from Concerned Women for America. They would interview Tony Perkins from the Family Research Council. They would go to whatever group it was, any conservative Christian group, pro-family group, and they would have balanced coverage. By the time you got to a few years hence, they just dropped the other side. It was pro-gay and only pro-gay from then on, and it's been that way ever since. And they had all these activists whom they had courted telling them how they needed to update their style book, how they needed to cover this issue, cover that issue, do this, do that, do this, do that. Well, listen, it is the case that when you are in journalism, you should listen to different people air their opinions. That's what the letters to the editor section is all about, after all. But you don't allow outside groups with activist impulses to dictate your coverage. You just don't do that if you're going to have any modicum of credibility. And that's why, in part, the mainstream media is a total laughingstock, because they allowed the sexual radicals to be the camel's nose under the tent, and now they own them. They own them. So, of course, you're going to have a columnist who doesn't stand a chance if he goes against the AP style book, because to many people, what the AP style book says is like God said it, except it isn't. It's not the real Bible with a capital B. It's just a propaganda arm for big gay. It's all it is. That's all it is. I'm not saying there aren't entries in the AP style book that aren't helpful because they cover all the subjects. But on the issue of sexuality, it's just an activist propaganda tool. And so this guy's like, no, just because the AP style book goes along with gay activists doesn't mean it's true. There are two sexes. So anyway, this is what happened to this guy. And going on in this story, he says there are only two sexes. This is when he was criticizing this AP directive. He said there are only two sexes identified by an XX or XY chromosome. That is the very definition of binary. The AP ruling it isn't so doesn't change science. It's a premeditative attempt to change culture and policy. It's activism. Yep. And it came right from groups like GLAAD. GLAAD owns the media. I mean, maybe not financially, but now you know that's what happened. He wrote this on January 3rd. In a column a couple of weeks later, he also railed against a 2019 Colorado law that required elementary school children to be instructed in transgender ideology. He wrote, some parents weren't thrilled a couple of years back when during school, their little ones in Boulder Valley School District were treated to videos stating that a transgender teddy bear teaching the kids how to misuse pronouns, or when Colorado's trans community choir sang to kids about a transgender raven. What are the protections for a parent who feels transgender singing groups and teddy bears with gender dysphoria might be stigmatizing for their kid? So then he says he was fired by the paper's editorial page editor, Megan Schrader, according to an interview with Westword published just a couple of days ago. He said, Megan told me I was the page's most read columnist, but there's now a permanently and perpetually offended class, and in order to speak, you need to use their terminology. There's a whole lot of you can't say that ism going on right now. And Schrader confirmed she fired Caldara but declined to discuss the reason. Okay. She says, I'm writing a job description as we speak to fill his position. I hope that conservative Colorado writers will apply, knowing that we value conservative voices on our pages. Oh, okay. And don't have a litmus test for their opinions. It would seem otherwise when we look at what you're doing. I look back, too, at my career, because for a time at the first newspaper I worked for, I was the religion columnist, and I ended up becoming the religion editor, de facto religion editor. And I thought, boy, I really made it out in time, because I would never be given that job now. Everything would be the rainbow flag. Oh, go down to the local PCUSA and talk about this wonderful new lesbian pastor. And I could just picture what would happen, because I would turn to my editor and say, no. I'm not doing that. Yes, you have to. You have to be inclusive. Or go down here and they have a new transgender vicar over at the ELCA. And I'd say, no, I'm not covering that either. I mean, how long would I last? Like 30 seconds? There's no way. But that's the danger when you allow ideology, particularly radical sexual ideology that is absolutely immoral, to take over what is supposed to be, ideally, a neutral publication that is all about truth. So should it surprise us at all that when we see newspapers today, or we see outlets like CNN today just flat out lie and propagandize us, that, you know, it shouldn't surprise us at all to understand that they're activists. And that's part of the problem, is they really don't want any kind of diversity, real diversity in their newsrooms. There's no conservative person who could work for the Denver Post, I don't think, who could say what John Caldara said so boldly and truthfully and retain her or his job there either. You know, if you bring in the next person who says there are only two sexes, they throw you out because the AP style book says there aren't. Doesn't make it true. This is craziness. It really is. I hope John Caldera gets a good job somewhere else, somewhere far from Denver. We're going to come back. Stay with us. You're listening to Janet Mefford Today.
Hi, I'm Kevin Sorbo. I wanted to invite you to offer your full support for the Ministry of Preborn and its leader, Dan Steiner. The team at Preborn is very focused and very successful at saving preborn babies from abortion. Now get ready to write down the phone number and the website so you can join the Preborn team.
Join Kevin Sorbo and me, Janet Mefford, as we support Preborn. The mission at Preborn is to supply pregnancy centers throughout America with sonograms. Ultrasounds are a game changer when it comes to saving babies' lives. You see, when an abortion-minded woman sees her baby on ultrasound and hears the heartbeat, she's 80% more likely to keep her baby. Your gift of $140 will cover the cost of 5 ultrasounds. All donations are tax deductible. You can help save a baby's life by donating to Preborn. To donate, call now 855-402-BABY. That's 855-402-BABY. 855-402-2229. Or there's a banner to click at janetmefford.com. The healthcare open enrollment period has ended. Did you miss it? Don't go a whole year without having a healthcare program. Sign up with Liberty HealthShare. As a Christian healthcare sharing ministry, Liberty HealthShare is not insurance, so you can still sign up. In fact, you can sign up any time of year, and there are no contracts. Starting as low as $199 a month, Liberty HealthShare has memberships for singles, couples, and families, so you can choose the ideal program for your situation. Plus, Liberty HealthShare has no network, so you're free to pick your own doctors, hospitals, and providers. Liberty HealthShare is a nonprofit ministry, so your money goes toward helping other members with their eligible medical expenses. And in your time of need, other members are there for you, too. You can feel good knowing you're part of a community of like-minded individuals who understand the importance of people coming together to bear one another's burdens. Go to libertyhealthshare.org/JMT for more information. libertyhealthshare.org/JMT.
You're listening to Janet Mefford Today. And now, here's Janet.
Welcome back. Guys, we need your help. We are partnering with the Ministry Preborn to save babies' lives, specifically 250 babies' lives, by the end of January. And we are closing in on the end of January. We're roughly halfway there, but we really need you to step up if you can help us. Preborn works with pregnancy centers all across America. And when an abortion-minded woman comes in, this woman receives a free ultrasound, is offered a free ultrasound. And 8 out of 10 times when that happens, the mom will choose life. I think it's one of the most effective, direct ways of saving human lives that I've ever heard about. But we need your help. It costs $28 to sponsor one free ultrasound session. And let me tell you something, every dollar that you give is going to go right to life. It's not going to go for overhead and all sorts of extra ministry costs. It's going to go right to the exact cause that we're talking about here, which is paying for the ultrasound. If you can give a gift of $140, you'll be sponsoring 5 ultrasounds, but we want to save babies. That's what it's all about. So if you've been hearing me talk about Preborn and you've been inclined to give, but you haven't called yet, please call today, 855-402-BABY, 855-402-BABY, 855-402-2229, 855-402-2229, or you can go to janetmefford.com. There is a Preborn banner to click, and I would ask you, please, during the Sanctity of Human Life Month, if you could help us out, we would be so appreciative. And I know that those moms, and especially those babies, would very much appreciate your support. So one more time, it's 855-402-BABY or janetmefford.com. I want to turn my attention here to something that was on the MSN website, you know, MSN of MSNBC. They have some, I don't know if this is a new site they have or a subgroup or I don't know. They're calling themselves Newsy. Cute, huh? Anyway, Newsy did a piece on why are the majority of white evangelicals against welcoming refugees? Or as I like to call it, we're going to beat a dead horse again. I mean, really, there are two stories that I'm so sick of because every outlet does these stories ad nauseum. One of them is the white evangelicals don't want refugee story. And one of them is white evangelicals have lost their souls because they voted for Donald Trump. At any rate, I want to go through this because I want you to hear what they had to say in this report. And I'm going to have some thoughts on this. This is first from reporter Ben Shimizu, who is the immigration reporter for Newsy. This has got one.
The recent editorial in Christianity Today calling for President Donald Trump's removal has rekindled the debate about why white evangelicals are so devoted to the president. But one question about white evangelicals continues to be ignored. Why are so many of them opposed to welcoming refugees? A 2018 Pew Research survey found that white evangelicals are the religious group least likely to support refugee arrivals in the U.S.
Okay, first of all, they've set this up to give you the impression that white evangelicals are just a bunch of heartless people who don't care about refugees. That's not true. And you know how I know that's not true? Because I know how you guys have responded during all of our partnership with Heart for Lebanon, the wonderful ministry that brings the gospel to refugees who are coming into Lebanon and living in those tent settlements. I know how much we have raised for Heart for Lebanon. And I talk to you guys and I know how much you care about hurting people who've been displaced from their homes. But that's not the essence of what's going on here. Let's go then to this little portion of the interview where Mike Bryant, who's a pastor at Chicago's Park Community Church and is working with refugee resettlement. Listen how wrong he gets this. Listen to cut two.
Mike Bryant leads his Chicago Evangelical Church's volunteer program to help refugees. He says his religious peers started changing their views on refugees right before the election of President Donald Trump.
It really started with the recent presidential election and even going a little before that with the rise of ISIS and the fear of Syrian refugees. People began questioning our allegiance and our loyalty to this country because we spent so much time and poured so much of our heart into welcoming people from other countries. And they began questioning if we were, you know, supporting terrorism or something like that.
Oh, my goodness. That is not what happened. First of all, it did not begin right before Trump was elected. It began under the Obama administration when they started prioritizing Muslim refugees over Christian refugees. And the concern was about national security, because you remember it was the case that ISIS was wreaking havoc across the Middle East. You had all these people who were coming into Europe who couldn't be vetted and then were committing violent jihad in Western Europe. Have we forgotten this? And so wisely, many, many Christians here said, listen, we need to be very smart about this. And we know that Obama didn't want to prioritize Christian refugees, who in large respect were more desperate than Muslim refugees. He didn't want to bring them here. There was one fiscal year in which he brought in 47 Christian refugees and thousands. It was something like 9,000 Muslim refugees. So Christians noted this and they said, well, wait a minute. These Christians who are being booted out of Iraq, the most ancient land for Christianity, you know, Nineveh is there. These Christians are losing their home. Their churches are being burned down. They're having to flee. And then they can't go to the UN camps because they get attacked by Muslims in the UN camps. Not only that, but the Obama administration, the State Department, was taking the UN's advice on who to bring in as refugees, people they could not properly vet. And they rightly thought and rightly said, this process is, it stinks. We need to be smart about who we let into the country and make sure that whoever we're letting into the country is not going to pose a danger to us. Not only that, but there is also the concern that in bringing over many, many, many Muslim refugees, you begin to change the culture. You begin to see what is happening in Western Europe, possibly happening here. Look at Ilhan Omar's district. So there's that. Listen to cut three. The report goes on.
Political science professor Ruth Melkonian Hoover just published a book about evangelicals and immigration. She says that white evangelicals are increasingly taking their cues on refugee issues from conservative politicians. But she also stresses that Democrats are partly to blame for that trend.
Particular voices within those parties may be informing opinion on refugees more so than what they are hearing in their congregations or what they are finding themselves from their own study of scripture. Part of why they are looking more conservative is that Democrats have become more liberal than they were historically as well.
Okay. Well, that's not true when she's talking about the fact that Christians are taking their cues from conservative politicians. How do you know conservative politicians aren't taking their cues from Christians? It's so stupid. They constantly act like we're all brain dead and we can't think for ourselves. And in fact, we're thinking for ourselves just fine. They just don't happen to agree with our conclusions. So listen to this. This is where it goes off the rails. This guy, this reporter at MSN or Newsy or whatever you call it, he gets one person on the opposite side of the issue to speak for evangelicals. And who does he pick? Let's listen. Cut four.
I reached out to every current and former member of President Trump's informal evangelical advisory board for an opportunity to comment. Pastor Rodney Howard Brown, known for fringe conspiracy theories, is the only one who took up my offer ahead of my deadline.
Okay, let me get this straight. So the evangelical position is represented by the Holy Ghost bartender, the guy from the Toronto Blessing, where people are laughing and throwing themselves on the floor and has been widely denounced as a false teacher by every sound evangelical from sea to shining sea. He's the evangelical representative. Exactly how many real evangelicals did you contact, Newsy? Do you see how these people slant the news? Well, this is what Brown says, and he doesn't even get the reasons right either. Listen to cut five.
I don't see refugees as America's problem. Refugees is the world problem.
The South African-born pastor of a Florida megachurch argues that progressive Christians are using the Bible to enhance their own political agenda. He also says that Christians need to, quote, take care of our own people, echoing arguments from the Trump administration, which has drastically reduced refugee arrivals in the U.S.
When people take the same scripture and they hit you over the head, you're obligated. You're not obligated to do anything. You have to do what's right. What's right is taking care of your house first. If these Christians are worried about refugees, then travel the world and help locals take care of the problems where they are.
Goodness, this guy is speaking for evangelicals. No, he's not speaking. That's not even the reason that most Christians I've talked to have concerns about refugee resettlement. At the very time where you have Russell Moore and his evangelical immigration table cabal pushing world relief at every single turn, don't listen to groups that have a financial interest in you following their advice. That's kind of a baseline, you know, statement that I live by. If you have a financial interest in my doing what you say, then I should take everything you say with a 5-pound bag of salt. And that's kind of where it goes. So now we have this issue, as we know, in Texas, where Governor Greg Abbott said, we're not going to take any more refugees. And just a short time ago, a Maryland federal judge blocked Trump's executive order, finding that giving states the power to veto refugee resettlement is not in line with what Congress intended. I mean, it's going to be a fight, and you can expect that these leftists are going to be pushing us from within to say, you are a bad Christian if you don't help fill World Relief's coffers. Oh, they're not going to say it like that, of course. They're going to say that you're just not a welcomer of the stranger. Use your head. You know, God says to love us with all our heart, soul, mind, and strength. We can use our minds and come to good conclusions. You don't need a liberal operative, political hack telling you what to think. Just the word of God. Thanks for being with us here on Janet Mefford Today, and we'll see you next time.